Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. According to social justice advocate Edgar Villanueva in his book, Decolonizing Wealth, of the wealth accumulated in philanthropic foundations, only 5% is given away each year, and of that 5%, only about 7 or 8% goes to communities of color. Yet much of that wealth was earned through the work of people of color. But how would things change if some of that money was used as medicine to heal the wounds of the past? That's what he advocates, as he also launches into a critique of philanthropy as we know it. And he'll be speaking about all of that tomorrow evening at 6:30 at One Bank of America Center at an event sponsored by New Generation of African-American Philanthropists. And Edgar Villanueva joins us in advance of that event for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be on.
By the way, you can find that more information about tomorrow's event, for which tickets are still available, at our website at WFAE.org. We live, Edgar, in a world of haves and have-nots, where the top 1% control most of the wealth in the country, and that fact might make most people view money as something that divides people, because it's certainly, politically speaking, being used as an example of the great divide that we face. But you believe that money should be a tool of love to facilitate relationships to help us thrive. But how?
Absolutely. So, you know, often those of us who, especially those of us who come from backgrounds where we have not have money, have a negative connotation about wealth and money. I know growing up in North Carolina in a faith tradition, I often heard that scripture from the Bible misquoted that said that the money was the root of all evil, where we actually know the correct scripture says that the love of money is the root of all evil. So I propose that money itself is not something that is actually a bad thing or a negative thing. It's actually a neutral thing. It's a proxy for our relationships. It's a symbol for exchange. It's how we use money on a daily basis currently, and it's how we have used money and wealth historically that has led to this division in our country, where we find sort of that evilness.
So it should be pointed out, I guess, that you, as you just said, you're a native North Carolinian. You're also a Lumbee Indian, and part of the decolonization that you're talking about comes from our history of colonization in this country and our history of dealing with indigenous people and also with African Americans. The book, the full title of the book is Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. I want to talk about the title, and let's start about colonization when it comes to money. I'd never heard that concept until I saw the title of your book. Is this your term, and what do you mean by it?
Sure. So ideas of colonization absolutely have been used as a frame to describe what's happening, what has happened historically, but also what is happening currently in terms of economics in this country and around the world. We all learn about colonization in schools growing up, but we often learn, you know, sort of a romanticized view of colonization. It seems very normal to us because it's something that, you know, we think of these colonizers historically as heroes who came and conquered and sort of spread the gospel of their ideology around the country. However, for me as a Native American growing up in North Carolina, especially, sort of the impact of colonization is very present. It's not something that's just historical. In many Native communities around the country, the dynamics of colonization, which are dividing and conquering, commanding and controlling and exploiting, are very much at play present day. My friends around the country, many of their grandparents were actually removed from their homes and placed in Indian boarding schools. We see what's happening with environmentally across the country with oil pipelines being built through native territories and land that is sacred. And so those dynamics of exploiting people of color and indigenous folks in this country are very much at play. Of course, if you look at the news today, we see that we're still putting children in cages. And so it's a historical kind of context when we hear the word colonization, but it's actually a dynamic that is very much at play present day.
So Decolonizing Wealth is the main title. The subtitle is Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. What indigenous wisdom are you referring to? I know you're a Lumbee Indian, but what do you mean by indigenous wisdom?
So, you know, I've worked in the philanthropic sector for about 15 years. I began my career at the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust in North Carolina. And being one of the only Native Americans that work in the sector, especially when I started 15 years ago, now there's probably about 25 of us nationally that work in this sector. I realize that there are teachings and ideologies around being in community, showing up for one another, how we view resources that are very, very different from the way that we use resources in philanthropy, but the way that we use resources day to day, often as Americans. And so the indigenous wisdom that I've tapped into to really decolonize, one might say, or shift my thinking around how wealth can be used, how resources are used, are ideas around fundamentally understanding that we are all inherently connected, that we are connected and related to one another, that we are connected to this planet. And when you really buy into that idea and understand that, we are not a separation-based economy, that all the decisions that we make day-to-day of how we use our resources, how we show up and interact with one another, actually have profound impacts on our communities and on this planet. And so that's the idea of a holistic approach of interconnectedness, of being related, of thinking about reciprocity versus extraction. Those are the types of values that exist in indigenous communities that I'm bringing to the conversation around how wealth is used.
Do you find people in your audiences and people who read your book and obviously get back in touch with you as a result of reading that book, do you find that they understand those concepts? Because these are the very concepts you talk about, these indigenous concepts that we have tamped down over time, historically. Those the colonizers didn't think in those terms. Indigenous people did. So now you're bringing all these concepts back to the surface. Are you finding people understanding them and or buying into them?
Absolutely. I've been traveling around the world and all over the United States having these conversations, often with people who are in positions of allocating resources. So philanthropists, funders, folks who work in local governments and oversee budgets, bankers. What's really interesting, where folks absolutely are having a learning curve is understanding our history and how we got here. Because most of us, again, are not taught the truth in schools and we don't understand our histories. And, you know, when I get into the healing and the steps for sort of reconnecting with ourselves and our history and bringing that into how we actually show up as leaders and how we use resources, I find that many folks feel sort of connected to that message. Because for all of us, whether you're Native American or not, if you begin to explore your family history, for some folks that's before your family may have come to the U.S., you'll find that a lot of these ways of being and existing in community and taking care of one another and sharing are very common values that have been, you know, that are widely shared across many, many cultures. What happens often is that when folks come to the U.S., we sort of assimilate to these ideologies of being, you know, individuals and of competition, and you know that we don't have enough for, you know, we have this fear of going into poverty, so we all work ourselves to death. Mm-hmm. Those are ideas that are not present with many of our ancestors, and mm-hmm. So I'm finding that people are really resonating with and kind of remembering these types of values when they begin to explore their own histories.
The essence of what you're talking about here when you're talking about decolonizing wealth includes a lot of the topics that we have discussed over the years on this program. You say it's about closing the race wealth gap. We've talked about that. You say that when we worry about affordable housing, healthcare, or education, all things we've talked about, that we have to be aware of the history that led to the race wealth gap. And you say that if we do not put race at the center, we're not going to get solutions that work for all people. Is the most expedient way to close that gap through philanthropy, or is it through other means?
You know, I think philanthropy actually has a role. Right now, there's a major debate around philanthropy versus government. And I think it's a both and. I think government absolutely has the most power and the most potential to create policies and to look at solutions that would help close that race wealth gap. But I do think the philanthropy has a role to play. Philanthropy has had a history of supporting, great thinking, great ideas, and lots of human rights activities, including the civil rights movement. And so I'm not saying that philanthropy is in itself something that is a bad thing that needs to go away. I am critiquing the way that those resources have been used because they have not been used equitably. And but I do think there's actually a major opportunity for those resources that are held as charitable assets to be used to think about how we can close the race wealth gap.
I have to say that you don't hold back. We're going to talk about that right now. But I have to ask also, because you don't hold back in this book and when you speak, and we're about to talk about some of the things that some of your criticisms of philanthropic organizations and how they've been set up and run and how the money's been distributed over time. Do you get pushback? Are people aghast at some of the things that you say when you confront them with your opinion of what the reality is?
You know, I'm actually surprised that there has been very little pushback. I think one reason is that the sector of philanthropy is a very polite sector. There's sort of an assumption that we are all good people. We work in the nonprofit sector. We are all trying to help. And I believe that's really true. I don't think anyone comes to work at a foundation or a nonprofit saying, you know, I can't wait to be racist today with how I make decisions. So there, you know, I think that the conversations that we've been having, the topic of diversity and inclusion and equity have been top of mind for so many social change leaders. And so I think that the insights that I'm bringing have been really welcomed and are helping folks actually understand the history and the context and a different way of thinking about achieving equity.
So we have about a minute left in this segment. Let me begin with one of the milder criticisms, and that is the fact that the majority of wealth in America has been traditionally controlled and held by white people, and that the most foundations that act as aggregators for the distribution of that wealth for philanthropic purposes are controlled by white people, and there is a white mindset in these foundations. Explain that and what the result of that mindset is, and you have 40 seconds.
Absolutely. Well, when you look at the data of who's actually making decisions, more than 90% of foundation boards are white, more than 85% of foundation executives are white. And so when you have a diversity challenge like that, of course, the dominant culture and the way of making decisions is going to be very white-centric. And we see that the way resources are allocated are also going to be reflected in that white-centric way of thinking and doing business.
And let me stop you there, and we'll come back and talk about the impact of what you just said on the ultimate receivers of this philanthropy. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest in this hour is Edgar Villanueva, a North Carolina native, social justice advocate, Lumbee Indian, and author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. He's speaking tomorrow night at Bank of America Center, which is the new glass tower, at 6:30. And you can get information about that talk on our website at WFAE.org. So before the break, I asked you about the fact that most foundations, philanthropic foundations, are controlled by white people. They're run by white people. The money comes in mostly from white people, and they have a white sensibility. What is the impact of that on who receives the money and the choices made about that and how that money is then put to use?
Sure. So you mentioned at the top of the program that only about 5% of money that foundations hold, and we're talking about private foundations, actually is given out to the community. About 95% of philanthropic capital is invested in Wall Street and in different industries to accumulate more wealth. And right. that's another topic there.
Which we're going to talk about. We'll talk about
that. All right. And so when we're looking at where money is going, of the 5 to 7% that leaves the walls of foundations or the halls of foundations, only about 7.5 to 8% of grants go to communities of color. When you're looking at Black communities, the top largest foundations only made about 2% of their grants to Black-led organizations. Less than 1%, only 0.3% of foundation dollars go to Native communities.
And are, so those when you are those the communities that need the money the most? Or are there other, or is this money going to people who do in fact need the money?
You know, there's no shortage of need out there, and nonprofits, big and small, have to raise all of their budgets every year. But where we see a problem of equity and a little bit of injustice, in my opinion, is those communities that have the greatest need are receiving so few of the dollars.
So is that because of ignorance? Is it because of this white-centric point of view that doesn't even see that strata of society? Or is it willful? Is it mean-spirited? Is it purposeful?
You know, I think it really is a lack of understanding and proximity to those communities. So when you think about who has wealth to actually start a foundation, right, you have to be a wealthy individual or family, maybe a corporation. And then often those folks hire staff that are folks in their network from their, you know, trusted network of folks. And so they are going to often give to causes that they care about or, you know, things that really have a direct line back to their personal interests. So like maybe their university, maybe different arts organizations. And so where we see these major disparities in the nonprofit sector is that for the last 70 to 100 years that we've had this philanthropic sector, those large organizations like universities, like large nonprofits, have had been privileged and have had many years of investment, whereas other types of organizations that are community-based, working in communities of color, have been marginalized or redlined by philanthropy in some ways. And so often there's a narrative that's created that is not true, but a narrative that those organizations have less capacity or less expertise because they may be smaller and have fewer resources.
So you work in the philanthropic sector, and your book is aimed, and the purpose of your book is not just to be critical, just to throw criticism to the wind. Your book is aimed at foundations and at the management, wealth management, and individual philanthropists and bankers, to kind of make them woke in the popular terminology about what the reality is from your point of view. And you don't hold back, as I said. You use terms like white supremacy. Now, there's a trigger word. You don't worry about turning off the very people you hope to reach?
I don't, because I've been to so many conferences and so many meetings where I know there's a sincere desire in the nonprofit sector to look at issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've thrown that DEI term around so much. And I got to a place where I felt like we are not fully understanding what the bottom line is or how to get to the root problem of these diversity issues. And that actually is white supremacy. I'm very cautious when I throw that term out to help folks explain what I mean by white supremacy. I'm not talking about white people who are sitting in the room with me when I'm having those conversations, but white supremacy actually is an ideology that is not a real thing. It's something that was created that we all, whether we're white or not, we have all subscribed to these ideas of white being better, of white being the expert. And we have centered that way of thinking and being and appearing in our lives every single day for many, many years. That's sort of we wake up and subscribing to those beliefs because of how we've been taught, what's in the media, et cetera. And so when we talk about white supremacy, it's not finger pointing to individuals who happen to be white, but it's looking at that ideology that is not a real thing that has to be dismantled.
Warren Buffett, the investor and one of the richest men in America, Warren Buffett's son, Peter, and Peter's wife, Jennifer Buffett, wrote the foreword to your book, and they became entrusted as a result of being Warren Buffett's relatives with enormous wealth and how to distribute it. And they discovered that investment experts, corporate leaders, other philanthropists were overwhelmingly white. And they also concluded that fresh ideas were needed to make a significant impact. What did that mean? What do they mean by fresh ideas? Just a different point of view? The fact that all the things that you're talking about here?
Absolutely. So, you know, they shared with me that when they inherited this wealth, they started their foundations. They set out to support solutions to improve communities. They found themselves in rooms with other folks who look like them. And that's often the case because when you look at the nonprofit sector and our diversity challenges, you have well-meaning folks who are really making all the decisions. And people from communities like mine, people who come from poverty, who have directly impacted, often are not in those rooms where the solutions are being made about us. And so what Peter and Jennifer Buffett have tried to do in their foundation, the Nova Foundation, is to really become experts at listening and taking a step back and letting folks who are struggling with these problems every single day actually, bring their solutions to the table. They've made an effort to invest in those communities and in those solutions.
Edgar Villanueva is our guest. He's a social justice activist. His book is called Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. And you have said that much of the wealth in this country was built on the backs of less wealthy individuals, people of color, and at the expense of many of those people, and that needs to be recognized by those in a position to be philanthropic. So are you saying that that's the way to have real impact, to recognize that you're doing something for people who got you your money in the first place?
Yeah, I think it's a really important analysis to have when we're thinking about trying to achieve equity or to close the race wealth gap. You know, often I think funders or leaders in communities set out with policy solutions or with philanthropic strategies that are really thinking about equality. Like if we have this blanketed approach where we give everyone the same thing, then we're all going to be all right. But we have to take that historical context into consideration that there have been communities for generations that have been marginalized and oppressed, and we're not going to those communities are not going to catch up and be on a fair level playing ground if they are not actually if there are not very specific investments that are going to help them catch up. And so that's really bringing that lens to our work, that historical lens that's necessary.
We're going to spend an hour talking about reparations on this program tomorrow. The presidential campaign has already involved discussions of reparations for those whose ancestors were enslaved. Some counter that no one alive today had anything to do with that in any way on either side of that bargain, if you want to call it that. But some were alive during the height of Jim Crow and during the fight for civil rights and fighting on the wrong side of history in that fight, and during the time of local and federal policies and laws that kept poor people of color, particularly from buying homes, and that in America is the way you build wealth. So if reparations seem unfair, is social justice philanthropy a good way to change that equation?
I think that philanthropy has a role to play around this conversation with reparations, which I'm very, very excited about. Honestly, I didn't think in my lifetime that we would, reparations would be a conversation happening among presidential candidates. So I'm thrilled that we're having it. What I think is really important, from my book and my experience, what I'm bringing to that conversation is that I think, in this country, we have not had a process of real truth and reconciliation, which often opens the door for repair and reparations. We are the only sort of civilized country, as some would say, that has not apologized or come to terms with its history and its original sins, like Canada, that had a decade of truth and reconciliation, like South Africa, like Germany. And so while I'm excited about the ideas and conversation about reparations, I fear that it could be a temporary fix if we do not, as a country and as a community, have a process of deep grieving and apologizing and really coming to a place of full understanding of what has happened to Indigenous people and people of color in this country. And I think philanthropy can support that process.
And I want to come back to that later in our conversation, too. One of the things that you alluded to a moment ago, it's not just how the money from philanthropic organizations is distributed. It's also how it's invested, because you said that only about 5% of the funds of any major foundation is distributed every year, and they do that because they want to keep that foundation strong and they want to keep that money available to them in the future. So they take the rest of the money and they invest it, which any smart person would do, and you're hoping that these people that run these foundations are relatively smart. But you say that foundations need to be more conscious of how and where they are investing the dollars that have been placed in their care. And you include in that group banks, venture capitalists, municipal bond holdings, and other financial institutions, because they are in some ways, sometimes, through their investments, perpetuating white supremacy, savior mentality, and internalized oppression. Yikes. Give me some examples of that, because I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Yeah. So, when we look at the entire portfolio of a foundation or, a social impact investor or whatnot, we really have to be conscious of all the implications of how money and wealth is being used. Doing good should not be a side hustle for these organizations, especially if they have charitable tax status. So, for example, in philanthropy, where we have almost $900 billion now dollars of philanthropic capital, about 95% of that is invested in private industries and in Wall Street. Now, all $900 billion of those dollars are charitable resources. So these are funds that have escaped taxation, where the resources from taxation, of course, would have gone into public education and healthcare and all those types of safety net resources for our communities. However, wealthy folks and corporations are able to start foundations, escape taxation, right? And then the majority of that money actually never actually touches the community. And so that's one issue. The second issue is how that those resources are being invested. What we find when we look at the investments of foundations is that the majority of philanthropic capital invested in Wall Street are actually invested in industries that are harmful and extractive to our communities, and industries like private prisons, fossil fuels, and that type of thing. And in many cases, the same foundations that are investing grants in environmental purposes, for example, to improve climate change, the same foundation may be invested in fossil fuels. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is the net value of philanthropy if we're doing good with our right hand, but our left hand is actually investing in industries and causes that are counterintuitive to our own missions? And that is a big aha for a lot of folks who don't understand that this is charitable dollars that would have gone into our public system, but now it's being used to actually support and build wealth in ways that are harmful to the very missions that we declare on our websites and on
so
the
if you
of
are
donations.
Running a so if you're running a foundation, where is your responsibility? Is it to the fiduciary side to try to maximize the value of your investment so that you can grow and have more money to distribute to the needy, or is it to your social conscience?
You know, I think that's a conflict that many philanthropic leaders are holding, because I do, again, think that there's good intentions behind how resources are used to help the community. But at the same time, folks seem to be values agnostic around how investments are being made and what industries. And so that the idea of accumulating more wealth at any cost to people or the planet is something that I relate back to colonization, because it's very, very much the same dynamics.
But isn't there a cost to everything? Nothing is free. Isn't there a cost to everything?
Absolutely. But, you know, there's an opportunity for foundations and folks, even individuals with wealth, to look at what they are investing in. And there are foundations like the Heron Foundation, for example, in New York City, that have made a decision that 100% of their assets will go into mission-aligned investments. Mm-hmm. And so they will give their grants, but they will also invest capital in industries that are lining up with their mission. So, you know, that's a trend that we're seeing and something that I think everyone should be exploring.
So I want to come back to something you talked about a moment ago, and that's taxation. These philanthropic funds escape taxation because you've given the money away, and the people who are giving the money away are getting a tax break, and then they're invested tax-free by these foundations. Are you saying then that because those tax dollars that are being avoided could have been used by the government to build social safety nets and other things, that there's a special responsibility among philanthropic folks to make sure that those tax-free dollars are being used appropriately and to the best possible way? Is that what you're saying?
I do believe that these are public charities. Foundations charities that are owned by the public. They are not-for-profit entities. And so I do think that we should have an accountability to the public to make sure that how we are doing our business, how we are deploying our resources are doing good by community.
Edward Villanueva is our guest. He's a social justice advocate. His book is called Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. We're coming right back, and we'll talk some more about this and this concept in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Edgar Villanueva. He's a North Carolina native, social justice advocate, author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. He's speaking tomorrow night at 6:30 at One Bank of America Center. Information about that is on our website at WFAE.org. The event is called Just Community Decolonizing Wealth Conversation with Edward Villanueva. So there, as we've talked about, there are about $900 billion in endowments, sitting in endowments around the country, only about 5% of which goes out in grants every year, and only about 8% of that 5% is targeted to communities of color. You're suggesting that foundations commit 10% of their assets to the establishment of a trust fund to provide grants to Native Americans and African American communities to support asset and wealth building initiatives. Again, give me some examples of how that would work, where that money would go, how it would be used.
You know, it's I don't have a game plan for exactly of how that would work. It's more of a provocative idea that I put out to foundations, because with the, you know, grant making is one thing, and we've discussed many strategies through the years of giving grants in a way that's more equitable. However, that those resources that are tied up in investments are sort of the sacred resources that we're not allowed to touch are tap into, because as a sector, we're so focused on generating more wealth with those resources for our organizations versus the community. And so I'll put that out there to be a bit provocative that, you know, in order to achieve parity or equity, we're not going to get there with just good grant making. We need to think about all of our resources and actually handing over some of that money to communities that have been marginalized if we think there's an opportunity for them to catch up.
So big foundations can probably afford to hire experts to help them decide how to distribute that and follow your prescription here. Smaller foundations and smaller organizations who are designed to give out money may not have that ability. How would you suggest they decide how to get involved and to put their toes in the water, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, I think it's very easy for all of us and even for listeners who don't work in philanthropy, when you think about how decisions you make every day about your money and how you might help the world become more just, we can decide where we spend our money. We can prioritize working with people of color led businesses. We can look at how our own retirement funds are invested and make choices around, not investing in, harmful and extractive industries. But even donors, you know, I think the way of the world right now actually is for folks with resources to invest in donor advised funds. And right now, when we look at the charity sector, Fidelity Charitable, which actually is based in North Carolina, holds the most charitable assets more than any foundation in this country. The challenge that we see with donor advised funds is that there's zero accountability or requirements on those funds to actually ever leave the bank. And so that's why Fidelity has so much philanthropic charitable capital now. And so we, because there's no requirement from the government, we all have to make decisions that, you know, if we're going to use a donor advised fund, if we're going to, give to, some type of fund in a community foundation, we want those funds to actually leave the doors of those organizations and go into community and be very intentional to make sure we're being inclusive. Support causes that you care about by all means, but also consider in your portfolios of giving to ask yourself if you're being inclusive and also making sure that those organizations and communities and that have been marginalized and have had fewer resources, that they are included in your giving as a way to be more equitable in your day-to-day lives.
So Edgar Villanueva has joined us for the hour via Skype, but sitting here listening quietly in our Spirit Square studio for this entire conversation has been the author of Giving Back, a tribute to generations of African-American philanthropists, Valeda Fullwood. And that book tells the story of philanthropy by African-Americans in the community with an eye toward encouraging greater participation in giving back. Welcome back to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you very much.
And I'm curious, because you're partially responsible for bringing Edgar Villanueva to Charlotte to talk about this very topic, how this topic, what it means for Charlotte.
Yes, I've been really excited about Edgar's book and have been following his work since before the book was released, and was in New York at his book release event back in October, and anxious to bring him to Charlotte. It intersects with the work and my writing in Giving Back, in that Edgar is a native North Carolinian, just as I am, and we're bringing observations and insights on philanthropy from a cultural perspective. Edgar within institutional philanthropy, and for me, my work in communities external to philanthropy, but all for the same cause around social justice. I think this conversation is very important for Charlotte. It's timely in that it's symbolic and also something of substance, particularly at a time when Charlotte, a proud colonial history, just celebrated 250 years as a city. This year, we also celebrate 400 years of Black life in America. Charlotte began as a Native American trading crossroads. And in fact, Bank of America's headquarters is right at that intersection, Trade and Tryon, where we're having our event tomorrow night. And so it really sets the stage to have this conversation. My Giving Circle, New Generation of African American Philanthropists, which published the book Giving Back, we periodically host civic engagement forums to kind of disrupt the echo chamber that can exist in Charlotte in the philanthropic arena and bring in new voices and perspectives. And so I'm excited about having a decolonizing wealth conversation in Charlotte and to explore what that can mean going forward.
No community is a monolith. And although a lot of African-American people are poor, and they're poor because of things that have been done generationally to them, there are some that have broken out of the pack and who have accumulated a great deal of wealth, and it would seem to me that that's one quick way to short-circuit some of the troubles that we've been talking about in getting some money back into that community. And your book is about that. Your book is about encouraging people of means to give from that community, to give back to that community. How difficult is that to accomplish?
I'll clarify one point. Okay. Giving back is meant to lift up the spirit of philanthropy in Black communities, which mm-hmm. is not grounded on wealth or financial wealth,
okay.
but more on more akin to Edgar's description of communities, Native American communities. So people even of modest means from 400 years when we arrived bring in spirit of Ubuntu or acknowledging our connections and bonds with each other and a sense of community has driven and informed our philanthropy, also our history in America. So much of our giving is through a social justice lens. So the book Giving Back is meant to lift up and celebrate those traditions and ways of giving that have existed traditionally in Black communities, but then also to empower people to be a part of the shift that's occurring in philanthropy, as Edgar spoke about, as we think more about points of white supremacy, as you mentioned earlier, and how many of us as Americans have been taught and groomed and rewarded to buy into that ideology. And Giving Back, the book, is a way of embracing African and Black traditions and providing a counter narrative to what many people might think and how they practice their giving.
You're a member of the Charlotte chapter of the new generation of African-American philanthropists, a group that's often referred to as a giving circle.
Yes.
Which comes from the African-American tradition.
It is born of that tradition, yes.
So can these circles, organizations like this, can they make a difference, or will it take a combination of the work they have traditionally done and which you're encouraging more of which to be done, and what Edgar Villanueva has been talking about, if we really want to make a difference?
Absolutely. I believe a robust spectrum of giving and celebration of all the cultures of giving and ways that people give, not just financially, but also through civic engagement and connections in community. And I think giving circles bring some cultural competence and proximity to communities and issues to bring new insights to how philanthropists can invest, and philanthropists in the broadest sense of the word, not just people of wealth, invest in change.
Cultural competence is a great term, and it's one that we've actually been talking about without using it, because part of the problem, if everybody is running these, who's running these foundations, and everybody who has accumulated all this wealth is pretty much white. Even if they have the best of intentions, they don't necessarily know or understand what you're talking about when you say cultural competence. Is that right?
Exactly. And we can't expect them to. I mean, that's why inclusion is so important, to have voices at the table and a variety of perspectives and that are respected and valued as part of the work.
You wrote your book in part to show the other side of philanthropy in the African-American community, because you say too often media reports and annual reports from foundations only show African-Americans on the beneficiary side. Do you think you come at this from a totally different angle from Edgar Villanueva, who's still with us, by the way? We'll come back to him in a second. Do you think you come at this from a totally different angle, or is what you're talking about not only complementary but necessary?
Yes, I think I totally support, and Edgar's message resonates with me and has from the beginning, which is why we're hosting him here in Charlotte this week. And I think I'm excited about the solidarity that Tomorrow's Forum represents, voices and interest of Native Americans, coupled with interest in Black communities, all of us Southerners, all of us from marginalized communities, and kind of common experiences and experiences with oppression from colonial mindsets.
Both of you are North Carolina natives. You're from the African American community. He's from the Lumbee Indian community. I'm just curious how the two of you came to philanthropy, which is what you're dedicating yourself to. I'll start with you, Valeda. What brought you to philanthropy?
Well, when I first moved to Charlotte, I landed a job at the Education Foundation, and that was my introduction. I had worked in the corporate arena, and that was my introduction to the philanthropic world. And then I went out on my own and as a writer and consultant and worked with a lot of philanthropic institutions locally and nationally. And it was in the course of that work that I was inspired to help form New Generation of African-American Philanthropists and to write the book Giving Back, in part because I saw the prevailing narrative around philanthropy, which seemed to reinforce the idea that, yeah, it's okay for wealthy white men to make big decisions about the futures of Black communities without really engaging with communities of color. And but I knew there was knowledge and resources in Black communities that I think we need to be reminded of.
Edgar, same question, but a quicker answer, because I've got to, I want to ask you about some of your prescriptions here for success. How did you come to philanthropy?
I was recruited right out of grad school. I went to school for public health at UNC Chapel Hill, and the healthcare foundation, Kate B. Reynolds, was looking to diversify their staff and called me in for an interview, and there I went.
you're very critical about the current way we raise money, the way that money is invested, the way that money is distributed, and you pull no punches about that, and yet people have opened their arms to hearing more of this from you. But you also include 7 steps on how to heal, how to begin to repair the damage that has not only been done by society at large, but by the way we give money and the way we invest that money that we're going to give out. You say grieve, apologize, listen, relate, represent, invest, and repair. Only have a couple minutes left, but in that first step, are you suggesting that we all try to feel the hurt people have endured through the act of colonization? And if that's what you're saying, is that really possible? Can I feel the pain? I'm a white guy.
You know, I think that we all have to explore our own family's history and experience with money and wealth. And so that experience is going to look different for Indigenous folks, people of color, white folks. But all of us have a history that has been lost and forgotten in some ways that we need to grieve. And so for white relatives, you know, I invite you all to do that work in your own family to understand your history as a family and where that overlaps and intersects with the history of this country.
You've also said, and you said this a few minutes ago, that we're the only civilized country in the world that really hasn't had any any reconciliation. We haven't said, I'm sorry, a lot. And maybe we never will, but that's one of your things that you're suggesting we do. What would that accomplish? And you also talk about listening and listening in color. What would we hear? So what would that accomplish, saying I'm sorry, and what would we hear if we listened in color?
So if we really understand what has happened in this country and how it has impacted all of us, we're all in this together, regardless of your background. We are going to grieve that and be moved to a place to apologize. Just this past week, the governor of California actually offered an official apology to Native Americans in California. But beyond just apologizing, which is really meaningful for the person receiving the apology and giving the apology, we're going to move to a place of action. And in California, for example, along with this apology, the governor there is creating a commission on truth and healing. And so I think we're so quick to jump to a solution, but we also have to actually grapple with the history and grieve and apologize for that.
I'm not sure we have time for an answer to my second question, which is how do you listen in color? So you'll have to get the book. Edgar Villanueva, social justice advocate, the author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. And with us in our Spirit Square studio, Valeda Fullwood, the author of Giving Back, a tribute to generations of African-American philanthropists. Thank you both for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.